This is Marketplace Money for the weekend of February 26th, 2010. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, supporting financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide since 1937. Putnam, a world of investing.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is Marketplace Money. So here's one of the common questions we get from you. Should I do X or should I do Y based on possible changes in interest rates? And by the way, when will those changes happen? To which our standard reply is nobody, including us, knows what the Fed is going to do with interest rates. But this week, Chairman Ben Bernanke telegraphed the Fed's intention in a report to Congress. And it looks like rates are going to stay low for at least the next several months. Joining us for some analysis is our Washington Bureau Chief, John Dimsdale. Hi, John.
Hello, Tess.
Now, I want to start off by asking you to explain something to me, and I hope you can get inside the head of economists and the Fed chairman.
Sure, that's real easy.
Right, yeah, good luck with that. But, you know, I feel like I've been hearing for months now that no doubt about it, the Fed will start raising interest rates soon, probably in March or April. Well, as of this week, not going to happen.
Yeah, they're still telegraphing that it's going to be an extended period before they raise rates. You know, unemployment is still really high. The housing market's not improving. And inflation is nowhere to be seen,
yeah,
which gives the Fed room to keep interest rates low for a while.
All right. So obviously, this is good news for anyone who wants to buy something on credit, any borrowers. But boy, for savers, the news just continues to be horrible.
Yeah. I mean, when banks can get money cheap from the central bank, essentially they're getting these loans for free right now.
Mm-hmm.
They have no need to attract depositors' money, so they're not setting up any kind of attractive interest rates.
Yeah. It does make you wonder why people are saving more. We do hear that we Americans are putting away a little more money every month, but why do that when the returns are so low?
Yeah, I checked in with Jeffrey Cosnett. He's a senior editor at Kiplinger's Personal Finance magazine. And he says we're essentially talking about two kinds of savers here. One are the new ones to the saving discipline. They're either unemployed or worried about it. And that fear of being out of work is forcing them to reduce their debt, try to set aside some money for a rainy day. Cosnett says those people are less interested in what return they're getting on their savings as long as they have quick access to it.
So these very small movements in interest rates that are of such great symbolic importance to bankers and in Wall Street really make very little difference at all for the regular, ordinary American household that has some money in a savings account.
But the second category, they're the long-term savers. They already have a nest egg, and they may even be living off the interest that they can earn on what they have.
So what can folks do about these low returns they're getting at all these safe havens, insured bank accounts, even, I mean, CDs don't get you anything these days, anywhere where you can get a bang for your buck?
Well, there are some relatively good investments in state and local government bonds, municipal bonds that are being floated for some of this stimulus rebuilding. They're called Build America bonds. Or maybe some conservative mutual funds that invest in safe companies, you know, like the big ones, Johnson & Johnson, AT&T, General Electric. Financial planners say that people retired especially, or thinking about retiring, you have to be patient with the returns in the 1 or 2% rate now. And then once interest rates turn up, you can lock in longer-term CDs or bonds that offer a better interest rate over 5 or 10 years. But as Ben Bernanke said this week, it's going to be a while before those interest rates rise anywhere near above zero.
All right. Marketplace's John Dimsdale joining us from our Washington Bureau. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Tess.
The Obama administration is open to forcing banks to reduce the principal some homeowners owe on their mortgages. That was the word from a top Treasury official at a congressional hearing this week. No specifics on whether that might also apply to condo owners in danger of foreclosure. Condos pose a unique problem. If your neighbors don't pony up, you're still on the hook. From Chicago Public Radio, Ashley Gross reports.
When Dee Hutchinson bought her condo, let's just say this was not part of the plan.
Oh my God, this is the worst.
She and several others have just walked into a foreclosed condo upstairs from where she lives. The smell almost knocks us over. Hutchinson opens the fridge, and it's covered with maggots.
Oh, God.
Oh, my God.
I've never seen anything like this before.
Hutchinson's here to take stock of the damage as she and her neighbors try to save the building. Foreclosures emptied out two-thirds of the 27 units here. By last winter, most other owners had stopped paying their monthly dues. That left Hutchinson and two neighbors trying to shoulder the costs all on their own.
I was having a fear of waking up one morning and I'd be the only one in the building. This just scared me.
One neighbor says she even paid an extra $2,700 to keep the gas on. But that wasn't enough, and it was shut off last April for 6 months, leaving the entire building with no heat or hot water. By the beginning of this year, banks owned 10 of the foreclosed units, and they're legally responsible to pay condo fees of about $200 a month. But collecting from banks has been almost as tough as from the original owners. Hutchinson says she didn't even really know where to start.
I personally wanted to go after the banks myself, but, you know, I can't just, you know, I wouldn't even know where to go.
So they turned to a lawyer, Ebony Wilkerson. She started chasing banks to get them to pay overdue assessments. But Wilkerson says it's tough.
It's not like you can just call a branch and talk to the manager and the manager pay. Sometimes we can get those contacts through the foreclosure attorney. Sometimes they say, hey, after the foreclosure, it was transferred to another bank, so that bank doesn't even have it anymore.
Wilkerson threatened legal action, and that got some banks to pay up, at least for a while. Bank of America is responsible for 4 units in the building. Wilkerson says the bank has paid big lump sum amounts on some units, after months of nothing. On others, it still hasn't paid. Bank of America officials didn't respond to numerous phone calls and emails requesting an interview. One spokeswoman said in a statement the bank makes every effort to pay condo dues, and it's just an oversight when it fails to. Paul Leonard is with the Financial Services Roundtable, a banking industry trade group. He says banks aren't set up to handle this.
The entire issue of a bank as landlord is a very challenging one because they're not in the business, nor do they want to be in the business of being a landlord. You know, they don't have, oh, we'll just switch over to our system to pay condo fees. They don't have that.
Still, it's in the interest of a bank to pay because if a condo association goes broke, it can destroy the value of the whole building. But Tom Skiba says this is playing out in condo buildings all over the country. He's CEO of Community Associations Institute, which represents condo and homeowner associations. Skiba says some associations have taken drastic measures.
You know, we've actually run into circumstances where we've had a bank foreclose on a mortgage holder, take back a property, fail to pay the assessments for an extended period of time, and we've seen the homeowners association or the condo association file foreclosure proceedings against the bank and foreclose on them.
In Illinois, condo associations don't have to go through all that. They can just take temporary possession from a delinquent owner, even if it's a bank, and then rent the unit out. That's what Wilkerson's doing for this building. They now have 4 units rented, and that money's going toward the building's common expenses.
We gotta warm up the boiler nice and slow, very slow.
That's the sound of workmen turning on the heat in Dee Hutchinson's building last October, after her lawyer spent months to collect enough money from the banks. But Hutchinson says it's unfair homeowners like herself have to hound banks just to get them to pay what they owe.
I shouldn't have to be the person, me, a little bitty person, first-time home buyer, going after a major bank, hiring a lawyer to go after this bank to pay the assessments on somebody else's property.
Hutchinson's worn out from this battle. She says fighting first with her delinquent neighbors, and now the banks, makes her miss the days when she was a renter. In Chicago, I'm Ashley Gross for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term goals at Vanguard.com. And by American Public Media, announcing Krista Tippett's new book, Einstein's God, Conversations About Science and the Human Spirit, available in bookstores now.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Time now to see what you've been sending to our inbox and leaving on our voicemail. And there is nothing like an entire show about credit cards to get your blood pumping with fury. That was last week's program, of course, a solid hour about the new credit card law. One of the big changes customers will notice is an increase in fees, including possibly those paid by merchants to Visa and MasterCard. Ray Nurmi of Marquette, Michigan, told us about his experience with those.
I have a small bookstore, employ two full-time people and one part-timer at 20 hours a week. If I could hire another person at 16 hours a week with the money I pay to the banks to process credit cards.
For the banking industry's perspective, we talked to Scott Talbot of the Financial Services Roundtable. His main concern with the changes was that they might make credit a lot harder to get. That sparked this question from Victoria Posner of Rochester, New York.
This is a bad thing? Way too much credit was extended to way too many people. Seems to me that a little less credit availability would be a very good thing.
A couple of weeks ago, we took a listener question about short sales. John March hears us here in Los Angeles and wishes we'd put more emphasis on the downside of those transactions. He's been through one and got bad advice from his bank.
Even though they got all their money back, I lost $80,000 I put into the home, got hit with a $15,000 tax bill, and my credit was destroyed. When I agreed to the short sale, I was assured over and over that it would stay on my credit report for only 2 years, and it wasn't as bad as a foreclosure. This is completely untrue.
And finally, on last week's program, we took a call from a listener who wanted to know the pros and cons of putting his wedding on plastic. Shortly thereafter, I got a little too caught up in the moment and let fly with something the FCC might deem inappropriate to our show, or at least the Dixie Cups would.
Going to the chapel and we're gonna get married. Gee, I really love you and we're gonna get...
Oh, is my mic on? Yeah, I was going to apologize for that until we heard from Matt Fichtenbaum of Chelmsford, Massachusetts.
I listened really closely. The voice was right on pitch, perfect phrasing, well modulated and expressive. Tess, you may enrich my presence with your voice anytime.
Why, thank you. And for my encore, I'll be performing Lady Gaga's Paparazzi. On second thought, why don't you just send us more comments, criticisms, and compliments at marketplace.org. The TV show Fame brought us stories of a high school dedicated to the arts. Now we have stories from one that's dedicated to the art of the deal.
Like, I do like to make money, and the aspect of making money kind of interests me. So I thought that maybe if I came here, I would learn more about the business world, which I have.
We'll hear about a feeder school for Wall Street coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Small businesses are the key to an economic recovery. We hear it from economists, not to mention the president himself. But businesses with just a handful of workers have to have a little something extra to succeed. Just up the freeway from our studios, we found a family store that's been offering up that something-something for more than 100 years. John Neese is the sole proprietor.
We're at Galco's Soda Pop Stop. I've been around since I was about 5 or 6. My nose fit over those little red bricks out front.
His dad ran the place as a neighborhood grocery. There's an Italian deli in the back, and Neese now wanders the aisles in a red apron, helping customers find what they need. But about 20 years ago, big chain stores moved in, and Neese had to change the business to survive.
My father had already turned over operations to me, and I'm going, if we're going to go broke, may as well go broke being happy and doing something I like. So I went out and I found 25 little brands of sodas and put them on the shelf. People would come in and look and say, well, what are you doing with all those old brands that don't sell? And when I got to 250, it's where you're finding them. Right now we have about 500 different kinds of sodas. Most everything is family-run companies, and I'm really happy with that.
We got a birch beer and this vanilla soda.
I have a Caribbean cream soda. It sounds really good. It's coconut with a gentle brew of Java vanilla, whatever that means.
Inca Cola from Peru. I haven't had it since I was in Peru.
Manhattan Special, espresso coffee soda.
I've got chocolate, root beer, cucumber, orange. I was really upset that the banana's out, though.
There's something almost romantic, definitely nostalgic about places like Galco's. Writer Robert Spector set out to capture and understand just what that is. Galco's is one of more than 40 businesses profiled in his book, The Mom and Pop Store. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Tess. Good to be here.
You say people always smiled when you told them you were writing this book. What do you think is so appealing about the mom and pop store?
Well, the mom and pop store is a universal. It's something everybody can relate to, and either they had it in their own family. In my case, I came from an immigrant family who opened up a butcher shop, or they have their favorite place when they're growing up, but more importantly, their favorite place today, because my book is not about nostalgia. It's about today.
You mentioned your parents' butcher shop, and you must be nostalgic about that one. What was that like growing up?
Not. I'm not even one iota nostalgic about it. I worked in this family butcher shop in Perth Amboy, New Jersey, an outdoor market where it gets cold in the winter and hot in the summer. And Saturday was the big market day, and I wanted to be playing with my friends. I didn't want to be slicing cold cuts or sweeping up sawdust. Part of the context of this book was years later, I realized all the lessons I learned when I didn't think I'd been paying attention.
And what were some of those?
The most basic thing was honesty. If a customer had a question about the weight of the pork chops, my father would say, well, come over to the other side of the counter and take a look at the scale and you'll see how much it weighs. When you're an independent entrepreneur, all you have is your good name. Therefore, you need to be an honest, honorable person in order to survive. Very simple stuff, but very important stuff.
You know, you also profile some very well-known companies that started out as small family stores. The biggest of them, of course, Walmart, which was a five and dime in Bentonville, Arkansas. Is that mom-and-pop feeling basically impossible to maintain once a business does start to grow?
It's even hard to do when there's more than one business, more than one store, I should say, much less building up a chain. And, when I mentioned before, I don't take necessarily a nostalgic or romantic look at these stores. Some stores are meant to exist for a certain period of time to serve the family, such as my family store, and others are meant to go on and do other things.
You actually talk in the book about how mom and pop stores are doing actually pretty well in this recession. Why do you think that is?
Well, they have the opportunity to make changes. And one of the things that identifies all successful mom-and-pop stores is the ability to adapt to change. People have been writing the obituary for the mom-and-pop store for more than a century. I have I cite an article from the New York Times from 1904, essentially saying the same thing. But they've always been able to deal with shopping malls and chain stores and big box stores. But you look around you, they are everywhere. They're immigrants who decided to open up a business because it's a labor-intensive business, so it helps to employ lots of family members. Or it's people who have dropped out of the corporate world and decided that rather than trading hedge funds, they'd rather use grandma's cupcake recipe and open up a little cupcake shop and do their own thing. Just to give you a quick example, I interviewed the woman who owns my local coffee shop called Hotwire Online Coffee House in Seattle. And Laura Lewis, the owner, used to be in the insurance business. She was an executive. And I said, Laura, opening up a coffee house in Seattle is not exactly the most revolutionary idea that I've ever heard.
When there's one every half block already.
That's right. That's right. And she said, that's right. But I did my due diligence and I looked at the neighborhood and the market and I thought that a coffee house with my interpretation could work. And it in fact does. And I end the book at Hotwire Coffee, and I even took my author photo outside of Hotwire Coffee because not only does she serve good coffee, but she's a community representative and just bringing people together. And that's what makes her particular vision a success for her community, for our community.
Robert Spector is the author of The Mom and Pop Store, How the Unsung Heroes of the American Economy Are Surviving and Thriving. Thanks so much for sharing your story with us today.
Thanks a lot, Tess. I appreciate it.
And here with me to take on some of your money issues is Marketplace Economics Editor Chris Farrell. Hi, Chris.
Hello, Tess.
I know you've been out on book tour, and every time I talk to an author, they have horror stories about what happens to them when they're out on book tour. What's the weirdest thing that's happened to you so far?
Yeah, I don't have any horror stories, but weird? Absolutely. My weirdest thing just happened. I was in Chicago, and I went on this radio show called The Man Cow Show.
Man Cow?
Man Cow. And it was a combination of Sean Hannity and Howard Stern.
Oh, I just don't even want to imagine that.
So he treated me with respect. He asked good questions about savings. And then he went off on these totally bizarre topics.
Can you give us any example of that?
Well, it was mostly, as you can imagine, sex obsessed. And then about Scientology and all white basketball league that's being formed. But one of the really funny moments was when Man Cow, and that is his name, looked at me and he said, "It's not like this on public radio, is it?"
And you said...
And all I could do was laugh. I just cracked up.
At least did he like frugality?
He loved frugality.
All right.
He was very good about frugality. Our particular conversation was very gentlemanly and got some nice information out there. And then we would go off on a different topic.
All right. Sex, Scientology, and frugality. That's quite a combo.
So, hey, maybe that's my next book. What do you think? It's not
a
bad topic.
I think there's a seed there, my friend. All right, let's go to the phones, please. Andrew is on the phone with us from Fairfax, Virginia. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, how you doing?
Doing well. So Andrew, you're in Virginia. Naturally, I would go to the notion that you work for the federal government.
I used to up until about a month and a half ago.
Oh, what do you do now?
I work for a defense contractor.
Close enough.
Yeah, everything that works close to the federal government around here.
So how can we help you out there?
Well, my question was, a couple months ago, I called up Bank of America and I requested to not have the overdraft protection because I remember I heard somewhere that you can optionally opt out of that. And what I thought that meant was that if I were over my limit and I tried to make a purchase with my card, it would just decline my purchase and I'd have to use another form of payment.
Mm-hmm.
So what ended up happening is I had made a purchase I didn't anticipate over the weekend, and then when I checked my statement on Monday morning, I noticed that I was low, so I transferred money over there while it was still pending, so I thought I was in the clear.
Mm.
And then that afternoon, I made two purchases, a coffee at one point and my lunch, and then the next Tuesday morning, I saw that I got charged with three overdraft fees, each of $35, one for the purchase over the weekend, and then two for the lunch and the coffee.
Oh, that's an expensive cup of coffee.
Sure is.
Yeah. And I know you guys have talked about that before, and that's why I had turned it off. So when I called the bank, they said that when I turned off overdraft protection, that they were turning off a service that they gave me where if I overdraft, they'll transfer $100 out of my savings for me and charge me $10.
So they claim that you didn't say you wanted out of overdraft entirely.
I guess, yeah.
Oh, boy.
Who knows?
Well, that day, right when I realized they weren't going to play ball, I closed my checking account right then.
Well, that's certainly a great way to go.
My guess is what happened here. Well, there's a couple things that happened here. But as a general statement, I just want to come off of, there's a new rules coming in July where the bank is going to have to say to you, do you want the overdraft protection or not? Do you want to opt into this? And in general, I think most people should decline it. But I would also say for most people, listen to Andrew's story, talk to your bank about, so what happens when this happens? What's it really going to cost me? What's my cheapest option for this rare circumstance? And for most people, actually, if you look at the numbers, it is a rare circumstance for most people.
Andrew, I want to ask you what it was like to change your bank account. I'm actually about to do that myself, and I'm about to call up the bank and say, I don't like you anymore, and I'm moving. what did your bank say when you left? Did they say, we're sorry to see you go, or anything like that?
No, I was really surprised. The lady on the phone was, I think she was their cooler, and she was just like, okay, sorry to see you go, bye.
The lady on the phone was a cooler? This is a gambling term. This is the guy who comes over to the table, who is hired by the casino to make sure that if you're on a run, that it stops.
Well, I was having no such luck, but...
I absolutely love this idea that the bank has a cooler. Because frankly, it seems like a lot of them are coolers. They just don't want to have anything to do with you anymore. They don't care if you leave. Do they, Chris?
Not really. Not at this point. But again, this is what I love about competition. I just love, there is going to be an institution out there that wants your business, that's going to provide you a good product at a good price with reasonable service. It's the nature of our system.
All right, Andrew. So be gone with you.
All right. Well, thank you.
Thanks for the call.
Bye.
We want to hear all about your money woes on our money line. The number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. You can also send us an email. You'll find the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. Chris, I think, didn't you move your money within the last couple of years as well?
Oh, absolutely. I'm actually in the process of moving everything. I'm closing my, I'm doing the exact same thing that you're doing, closing my checking account, and I'm transferring everything to my online bank, because I have to tell you, my online bank, the service has just been phenomenal. It's been phenomenal over the years. The only thing I'm kicking myself is that I didn't do this years ago. I should have just put everything in there.
Amen. Well, you can tell us all about your financial adventures on our money line. The number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or you can write to us. Just go to our link at marketplace.org. Look for the Getting Personal sign. And we'll be back later in the show with some more answers for your questions, including how to leave Las Vegas without walking away from your mortgage.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. And by Mini, featuring the 37-mile-per-gallon Mini Cooper with go-kart handling. Learn more at miniusa.com/info.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Most students learn about Wall Street in a single one-semester class, economics. If you're lucky, you might do a few stock market simulations, craft an imaginary portfolio. But imagine going to a high school where the entire focus is on helping you get a career in finance. Sounds great, until you remember that careers in finance went into free fall after those who had careers in finance got the whole economy into a spot of trouble. So how do those students feel about their chosen path now? We have a report from Rachel Kranz of Youth Radio.
Right next to the American Stock Exchange building is the High School of Economics and Finance. And for most of the students at this school, Wall Street isn't just their neighbor, it's their potential employer. Like senior Makita Loney.
Like, I do like to make money, and the aspect of making money kind of interests me. So I thought that maybe if I came here, I would learn more about the business world, which I have.
More than 800 students attend this New York public high school. The school doesn't keep numbers about how many students end up on Wall Street, but they have academic requirements to prepare students for a career in finance, like taking a class every year on topics ranging from macroeconomics to personal finance. Hiroshi Nohara is a former stock trader who teaches social studies. He says most students at the school don't come from a wealthy background.
We are a Title I school, which means that over half of our students, in fact 75% of our students, come from homes where their yearly income is less than $15,000 a year. They're barely surviving, right? I mean, these are families that are going paycheck to paycheck. You know, with the recession, I think there's no question that it's hitting these families the hardest.
So why do these students want to enter a world that in some ways hurt theirs? A lot of families have watched their savings evaporate over the last 2 years.
I think students are a little worried, you know, that stress and concerns about money that may perhaps they have at home that they bring to school. As teachers, we certainly feel that.
But he says these students have something that a lot of young people don't have. The school has helped them develop the confidence to ask questions about money, about the economy, about the direction of Wall Street. Take sophomore Shatik Gatlin. He talks a lot about money with his family.
I think it's more of me thinking they could have done something better, or me even speaking out and saying we don't really need this, or you know, you could have handled that situation with buying another pair of shoes or whatever the case may be a little different.
He says that the school has made him smart about money, smart enough to express his opinions to his parents, though they don't always want to listen to his advice.
Sometimes they do consider, but majority of the time it's, you know, they're the parents, so they're going to do what they want regardless.
Sounds like a complaint that parents usually have about teenagers. But the students here seem to enjoy having those adult conversations. Plus, they say the school has prepared them for life in this economy. And senior Makita Loney says she knows how to live within her means.
From freshman year, I used to always spend the money that I got, but now I've learned to save half the money that I haven't spent half, so I always have some backup just in case I need to do something else. I actually do have it in my room in cash, but it's hidden somewhere that I don't want to say right now.
Makita says the school didn't just help her look at herself. It helped her look at Wall Street, too. It gave her an intimate look at Wall Street's collapse and the loss of jobs and income that followed. Makita says she saw the effects on her subway ride to school.
I do notice the people that walk around every day when I come to school, like on a train. Like, I do notice that they have on their nice suits and their briefcases and stuff like that. But I also do notice freshman year was a bit more packed than coming up to senior year now. That even though I do leave at the same time, it's not as crowded as it used to be.
But she and her fellow students say they're still excited about careers in business. Just listen to senior Gabriel Munoz. Ask him about the future of Wall Street, and you'll hear the confidence in his voice.
Well, people are still going to make money on Wall Street. President Barack Obama gave a State of the Union where he stated that, you know, banks needed more regulation. And, yeah, definitely, I agree with that. We can't make the same mistakes. Every time we have a crisis, it's going to get worse. We're probably going to need to bail out more banks. So by changing the rules and, you know, how the game is played, hopefully we'll get things back on track and get this economy running.
Gabriel says after everything that's happened, he still wants a job on a trading floor as a stockbroker, and he wouldn't trade that future for anything.
Every single time I get off the train and I see Wall Street, I just get the chills, because it's amazing to walk through this area.
In New York, I'm Rachel Krantz for Marketplace Money.
And check out the other stories about young people on Wall Street produced by Youth Radio at our website. It's marketplace.org. Coming up, we've been watching these weird little videos on YouTube. Young women film themselves going through their loot from the mall.
Forever 21. First thing I'm gonna start off with, I bought 3 belts because I really needed some belts. This one is $580, and it's just a simple gold belt right here, and it has like a little rhinestone right here.
And thousands of people are watching them. What are they thinking? It's next on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. And I'm back with Chris Farrell to take on more of your money questions. And Chris, we wanted to go to Nevada next.
Okay.
And I'm sure you saw that the president was visiting there last week and talking about a new $1.5 billion foreclosure assistance program.
Yes.
This is supposed to help with Nevada and 4 other states where folks are still losing their homes left and right to foreclosure. We keep hearing that all these other loan modification programs are not working. So any faith that this is going to be different?
No, I have no faith.
Yeah.
It's a human tragedy. And the loan modifications have worked for some people, but it's sort of arbitrary.
Certainly the numbers of folks who have been helped by other modification programs, it's just a drop in the bucket compared to how many foreclosures there are out there.
Oh, absolutely.
So we've got a call from Robin. She lives just outside of Vegas in Henderson, Nevada, and she's looking for a little help. Hi, Robin.
Hi.
So I know that not everybody who lives in Vegas works at a casino, but may I ask, do you?
I do indeed, yes.
You do. And do you gamble?
That I don't. I've learned to stay away from that for sure. I've been around plenty enough to know that it's not something to get involved in, so I've stayed as far away from that as possible.
Good for you. Did you grow up there?
I grew up in a town pretty close to here, which also thrives on a casino community. I've been surrounded by this sort of environment for most of my life, yeah.
And I know that it's been a terrible, terrible, terrible real estate market there. So I'm wondering if that is probably what your question is about.
It is. 2.5 years ago, I purchased a condo. I thought at the time I decided to continue my studies, and I thought it would be a good investment while I was attending school.
How old are you?
I'm 25.
Why did you feel like you wanted to buy?
I guess because I could. I had saved up money, and looking back now, just because you can doesn't necessarily mean it's such a good idea.
Yeah.
I'm just making enough to support myself and make this large condo payment. You know, it's not worth it to me anymore. And I've talked to my lender, and I've been told every time that until I default on a payment, until I do some harm to myself, nobody's going to help me. And
is the house underwater?
Oh, yes, definitely.
Yeah.
And so I'm wondering, do I keep making these payments? I get told so many different things from so many people. Walk away now. Save up your money. Save up the cash.
Who's telling you to do that?
I've had some family members who have done the same, much older family members who tell me, well, you're young enough, you know, you can build up your credit again. Every month that goes by, I'm like, okay, maybe next month I'll not pay just to get the attention of my bank. Maybe then I'll have some leverage. I've been doing what I feel is morally right. You know, I listen to your show and I hear this conversation. I'm kind of lost.
And this whole walking away debate really just keeps going on and on. The bank is saying you got to stop paying if we're going to help you.
Yep.
And the other option is just to simply walk away. But I say simply, and it's not that simple, right?
It's not that simple. So there's a couple things to do that I would recommend doing, particularly since you have time. And first of all, talk to a real estate lawyer. And one reason is that state laws vary. And, you know, anecdotally, you know some people, family members who have done it and everything's fine. But in Nevada is what we call a recourse state. So technically, the bank could go after your income and you need professional advice, not family member advice. You need professional advice. What are your options and what is the hit that you're going to take?
Chris, what do you think about Robin talking about, you know, her moral dilemma? You know, is this an issue of morality, do you think? You know, if your neighbor has walked away, you know, why shouldn't you as well?
I have two positions on this. Yes, it is a moral issue. When you borrow from someone, you promise to pay them back. And that's what people should do. However, there's a reason why we have a thing called a bankruptcy code. There, sometimes life is against you. You need a fresh start. You need to start over again. There's nothing wrong with that. My feeling is the morality is important. You made a promise, but that does not mean that you for the rest of your life are going to be should be in a bad financial situation. If you're at the financial edge, then you have to think about these moves such as a short sale, a bankruptcy, a foreclosure, a walking away.
And Robin, I think what we're saying here is don't succumb to the peer pressure that you're feeling from your family and friends, because isn't that what got you into the house in the first place? You felt like you had to go buy a house just like everybody was doing?
Yeah, I think so. My brother actually did as well before I had. And I guess, yeah, it seemed like the right thing, the right time to do it. And
yeah,
I don't know why I thought that.
Oh, a lot of people thought it. So you're certainly not alone.
So I guess if we're summing it up, Tess, what we're sort of saying is, look, really explore this option. Get professional advice on what are the trade-offs. We're not saying don't do it, but just really do it, not because other people are saying it's okay.
Exactly.
But with your eyes wide open.
Yep. You think you can do that?
Yes. Thank you so much.
All right. Good luck with that. Thanks so much for calling.
Bye.
Well, we hope that you don't ever walk away from us. We'd love to hear your financial tales at our money line. It's 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. All right, Chris. Thanks. Thanks for the advice. Great to have you on the show again.
It's been fun.
And tax season is upon us. In a couple of weeks, we will tackle your tax-related questions. So send those in. Go to marketplace.org. And remember to always check with your financial professional before you make any big money decisions.
Marketplace Money is supported by Constant Contact, helping small businesses stay connected to their customers with email marketing, online surveys, and event marketing. Over 300,000 small businesses and nonprofits use ConstantContact.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
The financial crisis has prompted, if not forced, many of us to change our money habits, spend less, save more. It's a new concept in some quarters, but hardly a radical one. Nope, for radical financial change, try having the Berlin Wall come down in your backyard. 20 years ago, millions of East Germans who'd lived for decades under a communist system suddenly found themselves in a capitalist one. Marketplace's Amy Scott visited Germany recently and has a report.
The Central Railway Station in Leipzig, Germany, is one of Europe's largest. Its three floors of modern shops and restaurants look like a mall in any wealthy European city. At a small sausage stand, Katrin Dost serves currywurst to travelers. She says the renovated station is a far cry from what the communist German Democratic Republic used to be like.
Just now, all it's new. The buildings, the streets, and so we live better. We have new cars, and so it's very fine for us.
But for many, the adjustment wasn't easy. Pura Kauf was living in the GDR when the wall came down. She was raised by staunch communist parents and had grown up believing that the free enterprise system was evil.
For me, capitalism was the system that waged wars, where people were hungry, where people were unemployed, where people were homeless.
When Western goods flooded the market, Kauf remembers feeling overwhelmed by all the choices.
It made me anxious. At first, I just couldn't decide among 20 kinds of mustard and 20 kinds of hand lotion.
She found she had more choice in the job market, too. She had wanted to be an artist in the GDR, but didn't have the right political connections. When the regime collapsed, Kauf found a job as an art teacher in a center for children in Berlin. She and her then-boyfriend even managed to save some money.
After a while, each of us had saved 12,000 marks. That was an incredible amount of money for me. And people started saying, you have to do something with it.
So they decided to invest the money in the new market. That's when Kauf got a taste of the financial insecurity that comes with capitalism.
I don't know, 2, 3, 4 years later, the money was basically gone.
Kauf's job is also far from certain. The city of Berlin is heavily in debt and may have to close the center where she works. Financial insecurity has left a lot of people unsatisfied with German reunification. Johann Stadt is a professor at the Free University of Berlin. He says in parts of eastern Germany, unemployment is twice as high as in the West. Studies have shown that many eastern Germans long for the old days when jobs were guaranteed and the state took care of everything.
The people were taken by their hand and brought through life. And our society is different, completely different. So these older people, a lot of them feel that the old times were better.
Wir tragen die blaue Fahne, es ruft uns der Trommelklang.
Elke Urban does not share the nostalgia for the old days.
I hate this song. I cannot hear it longer. It's terrible.
Urban directs the school museum in Leipzig. She's showing me around a replica of a 1970s classroom. The song was an anthem sung by the Young Pioneers, a communist youth group. Urban says she teaches it to children to show them what life was like back then.
It was a kind of schizophrenia.
Her job in the GDR had been to teach French to school children, but because of travel restrictions, she'd never been to France.
I had to convince my pupils, this is a wonderful culture, this is a wonderful language, you have to learn it, but you have no chance to visit the land.
Eventually, Urban gave up teaching, but when the Berlin Wall fell, new career opportunities poured in. Since then, she's founded several new schools.
For me, it was a good chance, a good beginning, but maybe for a lot of people, it was too difficult to have no preparation for liberty, for freedom.
She says she's mostly happy with how things have turned out, even though she doesn't have enough money to own a house or invest.
It's too late for us. We had to have the reunification 40 years before, so we had a chance. But for me, it's no problem. I don't want to be rich.
More important was the freedom to work in a job she likes and to travel. After all those years teaching French, Urban finally visited Paris. She says the reality was so much more interesting and beautiful than she had imagined. In Leipzig, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace Money.
And this is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. We are in a TMI culture these days. Too much information. Every detail of your life right there on Facebook or Twitter or YouTube. I, for one, don't get it. Here's the latest example. And when one of our producers told us about this, I laughed and said something like, yeah, right. It's a YouTube trend called hauls, H-A-U-L-S, video diaries about the junk people buy.
Hey, guys. Okay, I just got home from a long day of shopping at the mall, and I just wanted to show you what I got at the mall today.
And a young woman sits in her room and tells you all about every single thing she bought today and why.
I bought 3 belts because I really needed some belts. This one is $580, and it's just a simple gold belt right here, and it has like a little rhinestone right here, and it's just a thin gold belt.
Here's the kicker. Some of these haul videos have hundreds of thousands of viewers, which prompts us to ask.
Let me start with question number 1. What the hell were you thinking?
Now, who hasn't come home one day and showed off stuff they bought to friends and family, right? But on the internet, for the world to see? And we watch this? Rob Walker writes about consumer culture for the New York Times Magazine, so we asked him to view some hauls for us. He says they fit right in with the social media trend where everything you do is worth documenting.
I think that the other element of it, which is really related, is kind of I'm a brand culture, you know, the brand of me, because a lot of these people sort of present themselves as some sort of grassroots Tyra Banks or something,
right.
And they have thousands of subscribers who apparently are interested. And then you read the comments saying, oh, yeah, I love MAC Cosmetics. So it really is being a little mini version of the kind of style TV that you might see in the mainstream media.
He says haulers probably dream of being the next blogger, tweeter, YouTuber to make the big time with a book deal or a TV show. And why not? Plenty of celebrities are famous only for their shopping habits.
Hey guys, this is Sylvia from Beauty Cakes. So I don't usually do haul videos, but I've been getting a lot of requests to do them. So let's start off with this. These are the kind of nail polishes that you can draw with. Like they have the
I believe that's Beauty Cakes, right? She's an Asian girl from Toronto, Canada.
Yes, it's Beauty Cakes. And that is Sheena Iyengar. She's a professor at Columbia Business School and just wrote a book called The Art of Choosing. We asked her to watch some hauls, too. And apparently, Beauty Cakes made an impression.
She has a whole bunch of things that she buys that are, quote-unquote, either cool or hot. So she's got that yellow T-shirt and that French Connection maroon sweater with pink writing on it.
So maybe it's understandable why people make hauls. But really, what about the folks watching them? What are they thinking?
I think what people are looking for in these hauls videos, it's not just about finding what to buy and what's the right thing to buy. It's about finding what kind of things does my kind of person buy. So they look at her and they look at the way she dresses and they look at the way she's talking and they look at her name and they think, to the extent that I think that she's cool and I'm also 17, then I want to join her club. I also want to buy the kinds of things that she has.
Let's take a listen to one of them. I know that that you've seen this one from the grocery store.
Hi, just wanted to show you a haul. So I just got back from Whole Foods and I got a whole bunch of new stuff. So I wanted to show you quickly 2 organic black plums. I got 2, I don't know if they were organic or not, but they were local peaches. 4 Braeburn apples. The 100 calorie packs of guacamole. Because I've been buying the fresh avocados and I love them, but I can't eat more than half of them.
And Sheena, as we're watching this, we're literally waiting for her to root through her bag and pull out peaches or plums. And I do not understand why anyone would spend their time watching this.
Imagine that you're trying to figure out what are the things that you should be buying. What are the things that are kind of healthy? And you can read about it in the various news outlets online. In fact, you can get a lot more accurate information than what you could get from, I believe that's Manolo Mandy. You get a lot more accurate information of what's really healthy to eat. But for people that relate to Manolo Mandy and see themselves as similar, then they're really curious. Well, let me see what she's buying, what she's eating.
Maybe that's why I don't get it. I didn't see any of my kind of person showing off a haul on YouTube. Guess I'll just have to make one myself, right? Or get, say, Rob Walker to tell me about what his haul video would look like today?
I'm a little bereft today. I don't think I have anything good. I bought some pizza, but I don't know. Maybe the crusts? I could have brought those home and showed those on on YouTube. That's entertainment, right?
Now that, I'd watch. And you can see some of the others we mentioned at marketplace.org. And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, hard as it is to find a job right now, imagine you've been out of the workforce for 10 years.
I went to wandering for a little while, and when I came back, it was just the wrong time to re-enter civilization.
Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Stephen Hoffman and Eve Troh. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, offering new ways for investors to pursue their goals with lower volatility on the web at putnam.com/absolute return.
American Public Media.